Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today it is my pleasure to welcome to the programme another lawyer. We seem to be having a run of lawyers at the moment, Mark Antonacci, author of the intriguing and challenging book Test the Shroud, referring, of course, to the famous Shroud of Turin. Mark Antonacci is an attorney and author who has studied all aspects of the Shroud of Turin for no less than 35 years. He is president and founder of Test the Shroud Foundation, which works to facilitate new scientific research in the area and also to disseminate scientific findings to the public. His first book on the subject, The Resurrection of the Shroud, was published in the year 2000, and his second book, Test the Shroud, was published last year. In 2010, he gave the keynote address at the last international conference held in conjunction with the Shroud's exhibition in 2010, in which he proposed new proposals for scientific testing of the Shroud, which we shall get into in due course. Mark, thank you very much for joining us on The Mind Renewed.
Glad to be here, Julian.
Well, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you after such a long time, because we were going to have this interview ages ago, but for one reason or another, events just got in the way. So it really is good at long last to be chatting with you. And we are, of course, going to be talking about this fascinating book of yours, Test the Shroud, which actually has the longer title, Test the Shroud at the Atomic and Molecular Levels. And I'm going to say straight away that I do recommend this book to people. I found it very absorbing over the summer. And certainly anyone who has an interest in this subject really has to read this. It is a must read, if for nothing else, because of, you know, the encyclopedic nature of the work. You cover so very much in it. And you make a set of research proposals which I think are very bold, that involve testing the Shroud for evidence of radiation. We'll get into that in a bit. And if that turns out to be, you say, that would explain a great deal and be consistent with the historical resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's a very exciting idea. It's fascinating stuff. I'm going to say, have some reservations about it, which will become clear as we go through. But I do think it is fascinating and very clearly worth exploring. Now, it almost goes without saying that most people know something about the Shroud of Turin. It's been part of popular culture for such a long time now, but I think precisely because of that, many of us may think we know more than we actually do know. That was true of me before reading your book, so that's why I'm saying that. So let's start with really the very basics on this, Mark. Could you tell us very basically, what is the Shroud of Turin, and why should we be bothered even to think about it?
The Shroud of Turin is a long burial garment. It's very typical of burial shrouds that have been used in the Middle East for thousands of years. Jesus was buried in such a shroud. The Shroud of Turin is about 4.34 meters long and about 1.1 meters wide. But unlike any other burial garment or cloth or blanket or sheet or anything that's been over a wounded or a dead person, the Shroud of Turin has two full-length images on its frontal and dorsal sides, and it has over 130 blood marks. These images are so unique that all of its features have never been duplicated, and the blood marks are even more unique. None of its blood marks have ever been duplicated. The blood marks and the body images are perfectly aligned. Those, in a very large scale sense, are the unique features on the cloth. And I'm sure as we get into further discussions, I can give you an idea what those features are. But the reason why it's important is because all of the features, the wounds, all of the evidence is consistent with the cloth's reputation as the burial garment of Jesus. And while that is interesting in and of itself, it's really not that important if we had just his burial garment. But what the evidence on the body images and on the blood marks and even the off-image areas indicates is that there could be extensive and unfakeable scientific and medical evidence that every element comprising the passion, crucifixion, death, burial, and even resurrection of Jesus Christ occurred. We could possibly have evidence in the 21st century of what is arguably the most important events in human history.
It is certainly a very fascinating object, and it is intriguing to think that it might actually be the burial garments of Jesus Christ. What a thought. And yet, of course, even if it isn't that, it is still a fascinating object, which really would have to be the work of a genius if it was in fact a forgery. So, you know, however you come at this, it is something that I think is really worth looking into. Now, but I'm saying this because I want to, before we get into this, give some idea, some indication of where I'm coming from on this. I'm going to confess to people, I do tend towards skepticism on this issue. Now, I'm not proud of that. I'm not saying, you know, that I'm right about that. And my intention today is certainly not to poo-poo everything and be negative about everything. In fact, I wanted to read your book and then to speak with you precisely in order to challenge my prejudice on this, because I'm aware that is a prejudice. What I will say, though, is that I don't think it matters from the point of view of my belief in Jesus, whether the shroud is genuine or not, and my belief in his resurrection is founded on the New Testament evidences, not on any piece of cloth. But I do think it is worth looking into, and I am actually a little impatient of people who say, you know, when they say, oh, it doesn't matter, what they really mean is, oh, but there's something wrong-headed or immature about looking into this. Now, that annoys me because, you know, I think that's just ignorance parading as superiority kind of thing. But my position is, this is something to be investigated, just like anything else is. And if it turns out to be genuine, then fantastic. And if not, Jesus Christ still rose from the dead anyway. So that's the way I tend to approach this. So I thought I would clarify that for people. But, I, you know, I'm stressing, I do think this is a fascinating thing to look into. Now, what I'd like to do is to invite you to introduce very briefly your proposal for research on the Turin Shroud. Obviously, we're going to discuss your ideas much more fully later on in the interview when we've developed more context to make sense of it. But I think it will be helpful to have some idea of what you're proposing so we know where we're going to end up in the discussion. So, you know, without a great deal of detail, what kind of tests are you actually proposing should be carried out on this piece of linen?
The Shroud of Turin has only been comprehensively examined scientifically one time, and that was in 1978. We are proposing two new areas of testing on the shroud, and in basic terms, like the subtitle suggests in the book, we want to examine the shroud at the atomic and molecular level, where billions of items of unfakeable evidence can be found. We want to test the actually well-documented hypothesis that radiation from the dead, tortured, crucified body that was wrapped in the cloth could have been given off and left, like I said, billions of items of unfakeable evidence within the molecular and atomic structures of the blood and the body images, as well as the off-image areas. And the type of radiation that the hypothesis and the evidence indicates is particle radiation. Think of particle radiation as consisting of protons and neutrons. And these items were not discovered until the 20th century when Professor James Chadwick of the UK discovers neutrons in 1932. He wins the Nobel Prize. And of course, it set off decades long of scientific work at the atomic level by countries such as the United States, the UK, France, the Soviet Union, and because of the obvious military implications. But ironically, this research has discovered many things and laid the basis for research on the Shroud of Turin that could ironically provide evidence of a miraculous event that would have relevance to every person alive or actually who will ever live. Because if a miraculous radiating event occurred to this dead body after the body incurred all the events comprising the Passion, Crucifixion, Death, and Burial, this would obviously be consistent with the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And the type of evidence would leave a number of radioactive atoms. And if these radioactive atoms are present, there would be three of these radioactive atoms. I'll be glad to get into more details later, but you could prove when this event occurred and where this miraculous event occurred as well. And if those also lined up with Jerusalem or Jesus' burial tomb or the first century, now you've really got something.
Yeah, really interesting. We will talk a little bit more about the detail later on, as you rightly say. One question that comes to mind at this point is, you say how it would be scientific evidence of a miraculous event. And I think what might go through a lot of people is, well, how could you have, in principle, scientific evidence of a miraculous event when, you know, a standard kind of definition of a miracle would be, you know, an act of God that intervenes or modifies the nature in some way. Do you see what I mean, what I'm driving at? Actually, it's a very difficult thing to define, but it's often seen as being something incompatible with scientific methodology. How would you respond to that?
With much of scientific methodology, it is inconsistent with it. Much of scientific methodology wants to reproduce something in the laboratory. You're obviously not going to reproduce a miraculous event in a laboratory. Otherwise, it would not be miraculous. What this evidence would be doing is the scientists would not be claiming that they have duplicated such a miraculous event in their laboratory, but they would have irrefutable evidence. I even use the word unfakeable, even though it's not in the dictionary. Everyone knows what it means, but billions of items of unfakeable evidence would indicate that a miraculous event did occur at this time period, at this location, to this corpse wrapped within the cloth. It could do that. There's been a lot of research in the last 50 years confirming the hypothesis in the Big Bang theory that, you know, how the world was created out of just a speck. And a lot of the evidence seems to corroborate the Big Bang hypothesis. No one ever thinks, well, this is not science, because obviously that is an even more spectacular or miraculous event, but you could never duplicate it. You could never create the universe from a speck of dust. And never will be able to, but you can still research whether that event may have occurred.
Yeah, that's interesting. So in a sense, what you're saying is rather parallel to an intelligent design kind of argument, where you might put it this way, you're making inference to the best explanation. So you have the evidence in front of you, and then you make a philosophical argument that says, well, looking at all the competing explanations that are out there, in the case of the Big Bang, a creation hypothesis would be the best one to go for. And in case of the Shroud, it would be a resurrection event that would be the best explanation. Although at that point, you're going slightly beyond science to make this philosophical. Well, I'm not saying that's the wrong thing to do by any means. You're making this inference, a philosophical inference at that point. Would you agree that's what you're doing?
Yes. Yes, in general, that is what we're doing. Because you cannot duplicate the event in a laboratory. Yeah.
Good. I always like to get the kind of logical basis of things pinned down. So that's great. So now, turning to you yourself, in the book, you say that you were an agnostic back in the early 1980s. And then you came across a scientific study of the Shroud, as it was, as that study was at the time. And that, at least you imply, that played some kind of part in your conversion. Have I read you correctly there?
Yes. Yes. The more I got into the evidence, and my initial reaction is what I find to be quite natural. In a way, it's similar to yours, although you're already a Christian, but I was an agnostic. I not only had a skepticism of the subject, I had it wasn't hostility, but it was a fear of the subject. It challenged what I thought was my basic philosophy of life. But it wasn't a threatening thing at all. I finally realized, gee, this evidence might be something to welcome. It might be very transforming, might be very positive. And I could literally deal with the question of eternity, of life after death, with a formula that actually has evidence to substantiate the basis of acquiring life after death. And as I got into it more and more, you realize it's not just hundreds of items of evidence. You realize it's thousands of items of evidence. And if you literally took one approximately postage stamp size sample from the shroud or a dot of blood, you would have not just billions more items of evidence, but it would be unfakeable items of evidence for a miraculous event. When I'm around scientists, they don't like the word miraculous for just the reasons that Julian said, but you can certainly argue an unprecedented event, an unparalleled event. It's almost a matter of semantics. But that's why it struck me as an agnostic is something I couldn't let go of. I guess it's the attorney in me.
Yeah. So for you then, it became a kind of existential question, really.
Yeah.
And I suppose that leads me to ask you, well, if that's the case, is it for you foundational to your Christian faith? I mean, if the shroud was shown to be a fake, would that unseat your faith?
No, not at this point. Not after 30 plus years of being a Christian and having a relationship with Christ and with God and with having prayed and had so many prayers answered. No, at this point, it would not. However, if further testing was done, it could not only be a basis of belief or faith on the part of many people who otherwise do not have that present faith, but for the first time in the world, since you're dealing with objective and independent evidence of questions that have never had any tangible evidence to support these positions, it could be the basis of a relatively universal or uniform understanding on the part of humanity. And so that too is intriguing.
Well, I can see how that would, you know, if it did turn out to be true and science shows that it's extremely likely to be the genuine article, I can see how, of course, that would be very helpful in drawing faith from people with respect to it, of course. However, I don't quite know whether I take issue with something you said. You said something like there hasn't been evidence with respect to this in the past. I mean, wouldn't you agree with me that the basic evidence for the resurrection of the New Testament writings and the historical research that can be done with respect to that, which gives us this rational basis for the actual historical event?
Absolutely. I agree 100% with that.
Okay.
I said that there was no objective or independent basis. The world has never seen objective or independent evidence for the questions of the central premises of religions. In this case, obviously, the passion, crucifixion, death, and resurrection of Jesus, the central premises of Christianity. And those documents that you described, the Gospels, if you compare them to like the number of ancient manuscripts that are still in existence, their closeness to the time of the originals, how archaeology confirms New Testament accounts, how it's eyewitness testimony, and these people went to their deaths over their testimony, and many other factors. That's just it. You cannot say we have 100% proof of anything, but you've got 99%+ proof of these. You would have if you had billions of items of unfakeable evidence at the molecular and atomic level, you would then. But aside from the fact, when you compare it to other philosophies, whether it's agnosticism or atheism or many other philosophies or religions, which had no objective or independent evidence, then you have a real serious question. And it almost looks like a lopsided answer, if that was the case. So there's a number of reasons why this evidence should be pursued further.
Yes, I see your reasoning there. It would be this very, very significant corroboration. As you say, it would be like another testimony to the truth of the resurrection. Okay, so let's give an overview of the history of the shroud so we can provide a kind of skeleton to hang our discussion on. So as far as I understand it, the standard position anyway is that the shroud first appeared on the scene in the 14th century. Though, as you say in the book, it may be attested to before that in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
But let's start there just for the moment. So where and when did it first crop up in the standard narrative?
Well, in Europe, it crops up in the 1350s. Mm-hmm. There's evidence that it crops up in the 6th century in the Byzantine Empire and was hidden away around the 1st or 2nd century and is discovered in the 6th century perhaps when the walls of Constantinople had to be rebuilt three different times. But as far as its evidence in Europe, you have a very, very consistent, well-documented history of this cloth from the 1350s on to today.
Can I just ask you a question about that prehistory of it, so to speak? I don't know whether I'm pronouncing this correctly, but isn't there an object called the Mandylion? Is that right?
Yes.
And now you mentioned this in the book, and it's really interesting what you say about this, because, of course, one of the objections that's brought against the shroud is that, well, you know, the face of Jesus on here just copies what you'd expect in the medieval times. But if, in fact, the shroud is the Mandylion, then that Mandylion image, strikingly similar, goes way back. Could you explain that?
Well, there's a cloth called the Image of Edessa, which is well known and is the source for the traditional image that we have of Jesus today, the long hair to the shoulders, the hair parted in the middle, the more refined face, slightly pointed nose or prominent nose. And there's a number of not only paintings that were copied from the Image of Edessa, there's coins that appear to have been copied either from this image or copies of the Image of Edessa. And this line of similarities is not just visual. And in the book, there's probably 20 pictures from the 6th through the 13th centuries, right before it goes over to Europe, of the Image of Edessa and the Mandylion. Historians wonder if these were not the same cloths, because they're also described not only as a facial image, but as a long garment like the shroud presently is. And at various times, they think the shroud was folded up. And at times, you just copied the facial image, and other times, you copied the full length images. There's artistic history for both. And as far as it being folded, ironically, they use a word, it's called tetradiplon, and it means folded like you would a beach towel. You fold it in half twice, which causes 7 fold marks across the creases horizontally on the shroud. And there is distinct evidence of fold patterns at 6 of these locations on the shroud. Now, this is not definitive proof, but it does indicate the cloth could very well have a history going back to the documented history of the Image of Edessa. Mm-hmm. The descriptions of the image and the cloth and some of the descriptions say that it's miraculously imprinted by Christ himself and things like that. So it could have a documented history going back to the 6th century. Mm-hmm. And Christianity does have a 1st century existence in Edessa, but it's very short-lived. And after that, Christians and their sacred objects are persecuted and destroyed. And so the cloth could very well have been hidden away, but we only have these historical descriptions, but we don't know how accurate they are. It's just sources handed down to us anywhere from the 6th to the 10th century.
Right, okay, but that certainly does undercut the objection that the shroud was necessarily just copying images of Christ at the time. It could, in fact, be the other way around, that those images were copies, copies of the shroud in its previous incarnation, as it were, before the 1300s, way back. Okay, so it does crop up then in central France in the 1300s, and then it goes off to Turin. When was that?
It doesn't get to Turin until 1578. The first 230-some years, it's in France, at least the borders of modern-day France. The borders from western Italy and eastern France would shift over the years. It's in a town called Liray, L-I-R-E-Y, and I'm probably mispronouncing it. It goes on to Chambéry in France, and it survives in France for a couple of centuries. Finally, the family who first owned it in the 1350s does give it to the Savoy family, who moved it to their capital in Turin. But the Savoys obviously had a history in France as well as Italy. But in 1578, they move it to their capital in Turin.
Mm-hmm. And before that, is it 1530s? It was subject to fire.
Yes, in Chambéry, France, It was involved in a fire. it left scorch marks and water stains on the cloth. There are places where it burned completely through the cloth, but fortunately, the only part of the image that was damaged was the area from the man's elbows to his shoulders. So it took off his bicep, tricep region of his arms. Thank goodness that more of the image was not destroyed.
Mm. And then I understand that it wasn't really known very much outside of northern Italy for really quite a long time. But then if we jump to the 19th century, the late, actually really very late 19th century, it was photographed for the first time by another lawyer, I believe.
That's right.
An amateur photographer, an Italian photographer and lawyer, given permission by the church to do that. Could you tell us about that, why that was significant?
Yeah. Secondo Pia, it takes quite an elaborate process just to get permission to take a picture of the shroud. And finally, he gets permission to do this. And by accident, they discover that the full-length frontal and dorsal images on the cloth, which had become pretty well known throughout Europe, it had been there for close to 400 years at that point. No, 600 years, from the 1350s to 1898. Mm. In his study at night, this is in the old dark rooms, and they had big glass plates of your photographic negative in those days. He's got an image of the face, and all of a sudden, it's a detailed, highly resolved photographic type of image of the man in the shroud, and you see his face is swollen. You see where he's been hit all over the head and cheeks and eyes, and you can see a man who's battered and bruised, and he looks like a human being, looks like you're looking at a photograph, and he's just stunned, and he realizes, of course, that this is the positive, the highly resolved positive image, and the cloth on the shroud itself that had caused so much interest for centuries is itself a negative. And they literally discover by accident there's a whole lot more information embedded or encoded in this cloth than they ever realized before. But it was discovered by accident.
That is certainly, whatever you think of this, that is certainly one of those wow moments in history. Something mm-hmm. like that to be discovered in that way is incredible. But he was accused of fraud at the time. Is that so?
Yes, he was. Yeah. And 33 years later, 1931, Giuseppe Henri takes more photos of the shroud, and he gets the same result. His pictures are a little better only because the art of photography has advanced. Then they realize, oh no, Pia's images were not a fraud at all. And that's the typical reaction of people, is to dismiss this. This is a hoax. One of the reasons for this is, while a shroud is mentioned in the Bible, in the Gospels, there's no mention of an image. And so people are naturally skeptical. And I'll get into a little bit of the evidence. The image is such, this is one of the features radiation can do. Radiation can cause an image to develop over time. My friends and I, 30-some years ago, we used to take a piece of cloth and we would irradiate it with a circle of just ultraviolet lighting. And we would turn it off. We would use it for 30 seconds, 2 minutes, whatever. Every time we did it, you couldn't see anything. So finally, we took a piece of cloth and irradiated it with a circle of UV radiation and then put it in an oven at a very low temperature for about, I think, an hour or something like that. When we took it out of the oven, the whole square piece of linen had gotten darker from its white color. But the circle stood out, and it got much darker than the background square did. It's like a straw yellow color. And that just proved a little principle there. If you artificially age something, you dry it out, you oxidize and dehydrate it, where the radiation hit the cloth will develop over time. And if the shroud was irradiated in 30 AD, there wouldn't have been an image on the cloth for probably at least a few decades. And the semi-legendary story of the image of Edessa talks about an image for a brief period in the first century. But at any rate, if radiation caused the image, and I guess this is an awkward introduction to the subject, but if radiation caused the image on a shroud, it would not have been on there when Joseph and Peter go into the tomb, or when anyone had seen the shroud for at least a couple of decades, at least.
Right, I see. And I agree with you that one would expect, had it been visible at the time, that it would have been mentioned in the gospel accounts. I think that's reasonable to expect that, yeah. One thing I would say, and that is that although you may well be right, the radiation may account for that, others have suggested other things that may account for that. I mean, one thing that came up was an article by Rogers and Arnoldi from 2003, where they suggested something called the Maillard reaction. So this is the natural vapors coming from the body, so ammonia, related compounds somehow reacting with the impurities in the cloth. They reckon that that would, over time, develop the image.
I talk about Ray Rogers' work in my book, Test the Shroud. I devote a whole chapter to his explanation of the shroud's carbon dating, and I devote an entire appendix to his image-forming hypothesis. His work does not stand up to critical analysis or investigation. Let me just try to address it as briefly as I can. Ray Rogers is not able to duplicate the known features that are on the shroud's body image. He's not able to duplicate these features on one fiber, let alone tens of thousands of body image fibers throughout the body images. He doesn't produce any kind of images that you see on the shroud, the full-length frontal or dorsal, no blood marks. This is just a hypothesis from someone who was a former STIRP scientist, but that's all it is. It does not stand up to critical analysis at all.
But when you look at the paper, there are some photographs and some descriptions, at least claiming that some kind of discoloration was produced. I mean, maybe you're right that, you know, the full image isn't produced, but some kind of discoloration on the cloth.
Yes, you can get some discoloration. The fibers are colored in a 360-degree direction, and he mostly just works with that, but he can't get the color around one fiber, let alone all of them. Naturalistic hypotheses are even harder to defend than artistic hypotheses.
Right.
Think of all the billions of people who have been covered, alive or dead, in sheets, blankets, shrouds, soldiers' uniforms, shirts, jackets. There's nothing remotely close to all the findings that you have on the shroud. A naturalistic method is really a stretch.
Absolutely. I agree. And in fact, that came out very strongly in your book. And as I was reading it, I thought, yes, you've really got a point there. However, that then suggests the alternative to that, which is that you may have an artist using processes which themselves are naturalistic, but they're guided by the intelligence of the artist. So it would have to be that kind of thing that I would even have a chance with me of being taken seriously there. So I presumed that's the kind of thing that he had in mind.
Yes, but they're just as difficult to support. Naturalistic hypotheses have had worse results than artistic hypotheses. They have all failed, but artistic hypothesis has done a better job with some aspects, as you say. But the problem with the artistic hypothesis is this is clearly a human being that was wrapped in the cloth.
Sure.
You need a human being, and it's hard to get very artistic, even if you're trying to guide a process. It's hard to get artistic
with a corpse.
For years, the good thing about Secondo Pia's discovery was that for years it was quite fashionable, based upon a document from a bishop in France, that the shroud was a painting. Immediately, scientists, when they saw that the image was a photographic negative, they realized, gee, that's almost impossible. Paint a negative that turns out to have a positive image. And of course, subsequent investigation in 1978 will clearly say that the shroud image does not consist of paint.
Okay, yeah, yeah. We'll get on to some of those things in a minute. One thing I want to just jump back to is that back in the 14th century, I believe it was, well, at least somebody claimed to admit to the forgery at the time.
Yes. According to Bishop Darsus, he says, now you've got what lawyers would call is not only hearsay, you have compounded hearsay. You have several layers of hearsay. Hearsay is when somebody other than the original person who they're claiming made a statement, somebody is saying what somebody else said. And what he claims is that 30 years ago, someone claimed that an unnamed artist confessed to painting the shroud, and that he confesses this to the person who held the same position as Bishop Darsus did. And they still have many records from those days, from the diocese which he presided over. There's no evidence whatsoever of anyone hearing or making such a statement, or the process he used. And it's pretty doggone impossible to paint the images that you have on the shroud for extensive amounts of reasons, which I devote chapters to in both my 2000 and 2016 book.
Yeah, well, I actually didn't take that objection too seriously. I mean, one of the other papers that I read on this made the point that around that time in the medieval period, of course, various towns were competing against each other for pilgrims for business reasons. And of course, so anybody from any town could have said, oh, well, that's not a genuine icon, you know. So, I mean, these kinds of things could have come from anywhere. So I put that one aside anyway. Can we come to the acronym is STIRP. So we're coming up to 1978. Now, this is the Shroud of Turin Research Project, which the Vatican did eventually give permission for this to go ahead. Remarkable project. Could you tell us something about STIRP and what they managed to achieve?
STIRP, in a way, is similar to Secondo Pio. They discover many things from the shroud that they had no idea was on there. In the mid-1970s, a few scientists, John Jackson, Eric Jumper, Don Lynn, John Laurie, these are some of the earlier ones, Bob Deniger, they start talking. Jackson and a guy named Bill Moturn and Jumper, they've got the image on the shroud, and computer technology is just in its infancy. And they wanted to test Vigdon's observation. This is hard to describe non-visually. Okay. Vigdon says, take the facial image. It's also true for the entire frontal image, but it's easier to picture with the face. Vigdon says that if a man laid on his back and you looked at his profile, his nose would be the highest point if his head, the back of his head's on the ground.
Sure.
His nose would be the highest point. His forehead would be the next highest point. His cheek would be the third highest point. His lips would probably be the fourth. His chin would probably be the fifth. But you get the point. There's various areas of relief or prominence on the face. Yeah. And he says if you took a photograph, the brighter parts would be the highest points, like the nose, the forehead, things like that. On the cloth itself, these would be the darkest points. And he wanted to test this hypothesis. Okay. And they had a new computer image device. It was called a VP8 image analyzer. And anyway, it could display relief. And they not only found that Vigdon's general observation was correct, they found there was a correlation everywhere throughout the frontal image of the intensity of the color on the shroud and its distance from cloth. And they found that when they draped the cloth over the full-length body image, that this correlation existed throughout the entire image. This had never been heard of before. And to think that a medieval forger could encode this is absurd. He'd have no way of ever testing his work or anything like that.
So this was not this is not a normal photographic image then. Is that the point you're making?
Yes. Well, that caused the group of scientists to grow.
Okay.
STIRP would become about 30 scientists. And then...
Can I just ask, though, but sure. If I were to take a photograph of somebody's face, and I had a negative image, and I subjected that to the VP8, which you just described, would that then convert to a 3D image?
Oh, no, it'd be very distorted, because the colors, or the intensity of colors, on your face, the reason that your lips are kind of pink, and the reason that your shirt collar is whatever color it is, or the reason your hair is black or brown or blonde or gray, and the reason that your cheeks are flesh colored or your eyes are blue or hazel, whatever color they are, have nothing to do with their distance from the camera. Well, if you took a picture of your face and put it in a VP image analyzer, it would all be distorted. Only if the coloration or the intensity of colors was directly correlated to their distance from the camera, which is the source of encoding, would the image come out in a perfect three-dimensional image that a real face has.
Right. So this is a remarkable image, and that's why it caused the scientists to say, hey, we've got to really look at this as a proper research project.
Then they took some of the body image and scanned it under some other computer imaging devices. And when they put the body image underneath there, well, for example, if you took a painted picture and you put it under, I don't need to give you the names of the things, microdensitometer with a high frequency television image and that kind of stuff. But you would see brush strokes going to the left or the right or up or down or any angle in between. You could see a direction in the paint. When they put the body image underneath these devices, it was random. There was no directionality to it. The only directionality they could see on the body image would be a vertical and horizontal weave on the cloth. But that's not the body image showing any directionality. That's just seeing the weave. That's how sensitive the instruments were. This is the kind of thing that made them form STIRP. And by surprise, they were having a display of the Shroud in 1978. It hadn't occurred since the 30s. And to celebrate the cloth's arrival in Turin in 1578, they were having an exhibition of the Shroud in 1978. They asked permission in the summer of 78, could we have some time to examine the Shroud under non-destructive techniques at the end of the exhibit? And they said, okay. It was a surprise, and then they discovered all kinds of things. I'll give you one example. They found out, as a result of that and other studies, they would continue on the Shroud afterward, that the directionality to the Shroud's image was even more unique than they thought. Picture an individual laying on his back on the bottom part of a 4.34-meter length of a cloth, and the rest of the cloth is folded over the top of him. And when you fold it over the top of him and just let go of it, it will naturally drape over the man's body and show an outline, and parts of the cloth will have an angled slope downward. Part of it will be relatively flat. Parts of it will be angling in an upward direction. But regardless of how the cloth draped over the body, the image was encoded in a vertical, straight line direction from the cloth to whatever part of the body it was under. This had never been heard of before. And the analogous description by one of the STIRP scientists was that it was like every pore of the man's body and hair. It was as if it had a micro miniature laser up to the cloth, as if it gave off that information in that direction. So you start, when you look at the photographic aspect of the image and everything else, you start at myself as an attorney in the early 80s. I'm starting to read this and you're thinking, oh, the only explanation for such an encoding process is radiation. And that's the beginning of many, many other signs of radiation.
I see it's highly suggestive of it, and I think it's a very interesting hypothesis, and we will come back to that in greater detail in a bit. A few other things that I want to ask you about the evidence, because there are a lot of things here. Now, the blood marks on the shroud, I understand, are actual blood. Is that right?
Yes, and you can do even more definitive tests, but all the testing from the early 1980s, STIRP would take blood samples back with them to laboratories around the world. And about 15 different tests conclude it's not just blood, it's human blood.
Okay. Well, what about this guy called Walter McCrone? He tested the shroud, a chemist apparently, and he said, no, it's a paint pigment, and he identified it as red ochre.
Yes.
And he also identified vermilion and red ochre in the bloodstains.
You will find a lot of things on the shroud. You'll find dust and mites and animal hair, paint. You'll find a lot of things on any object that's centuries old. There's even a little bit of bacteria and mold. There's many things.
Why would you find paint on it?
Well, for centuries, and it's well documented, many people would bring objects with them when the shroud was displayed, and they would touch the shroud to sanctify the article that they touched on the shroud. And they would touch it themselves. They would kiss it. There's many cases where they'd laid the paintings on the shroud, whether these were copies of the shroud or not. And this happened for centuries. You would get flakes of paint on the shroud in the room where the shroud was tested in 1978. And I've been there. It's the Savoy Palace where the shroud was displayed and has been several times since. It's very ornate, very impressive. Flakes of paint in that would fall off at times when they're examining it. But there's no correlation between the presence of flakes of paint that they've seen at the microscopic level and the body image. It's just at minute places all over the cloth, as well as many other places.
Ah, I see. That's very interesting. That's a bit fatal to his argument then. It doesn't just appear on the image points. It's everywhere. Okay. Well, what about the wounds then? So we have a side wound, which is consistent with John's gospel, that Jesus was pierced by the Roman soldiers.
Yes.
We also have whipping marks. Are they also consistent with the gospels?
Just as much as John's piercing in the side. The head wounds are all consistent with how crowns in ancient times in the East would have been placed over the head.
Yes, I noticed that. So it's more of a cap than the crown that goes round in a circle all the way around the head.
Yes, our artistic history more or less depicts wreathlets, like the kind of crown Caesar would have worn.
Yes.
But in the East, in ancient times, they used a full cap that set over the entire head. And the man has about 30 wounds on his forehead and the front and the back of his head. You have to understand that the crown of the head itself is not imaged on the shroud, which is consistent with the upper part of the cloth being folded over onto the top of the man's body so that he lies on the bottom part of the shroud and the top part of the shroud, and there's a little curled vacuum by the head where it's just too far from the cloth to get encoded.
Okay, and the whipping marks, I understand that they include evidence of actual objects being tied into the strands of the whip.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's what the Romans did, isn't it? They would add things to there.
This matches excavated flagrums from Herculaneum, Pompeii's sister city that was destroyed in the first century. They all have indented centers and upraised edges, and they're little barbell shaped, which is often what you found at the ends of a flagrum. And they have cerium around the borders. None of this could be seen until the late 20th century with photographic enlargers and microscopes, and then you could identify the human blood cerium around the edges. But none of this could be seen. To think that somebody could encode such detail and never get it wrong artistically. Without using a real human body is impossible.
Well, that's it. Without using a real human body. So perhaps a human body was used if it's a fake. I mean, one thing about the serum I wondered is maybe the forger was lucky in that sense, that used real blood and the serum separated from the red part of the blood, you know. And okay, it turns up later in modern scientific research, well, the forger didn't know that, but then they didn't intend that, and they just got lucky with that.
Right. But it does dispel Macron and other artistic hypotheses.
Absolutely. Yes, very good point indeed. I mean, one other thing you could say is that, well, of course, you would expect somebody who was forging this to come up with all these things. Well, many of these things anyway, that, you know, they would know there was whipping done by the Roman soldiers. They'd know that from the gospel accounts, you know, also that there was this crown put on the top. They would know that there'd be blood due to the wounds in the hand, etc. So, of course, they would have encoded these things. However, they actually did it. They would have encoded it onto the shroud. However, the thing that I think really does impress me about these types of evidences, as you've already intimated, is those elements of the detail that they couldn't have known about, or you wouldn't expect them to have known about in medieval times. And so I'm thinking here, the things that particularly impress me are the trajectories of the blood, which are consistent with crucifixion. And this struck me particularly because I read Martin Hengel's book on the crucifixion, which has got some pretty graphic descriptions in it. And I thought, good heavens, yes. The motions of pushing it, pulling yourself up, and, you know, against the gravity pulling you down on the cross, and you have to push yourself up again in order to breathe. Really gruesome means of death. You say that the blood flow is actually consistent with that up and down movement.
Oh, yes. All the wounds from head to feet on both sides of the body are consistent with the type of wound he received and when he received. He receives all his wounds in the vertical position. He's either had his arms tied in front of him or above him when he's scourged. When the blood flows from his head, he's in the vertical position. It goes down toward his eyebrows. When he's stabbed in the side, the flow, and it's a post-mortem flow, flows vertically, and there is not only blood, but a clear watery fluid, way too much to be accounted for by serum at the edges. This is post-mortem. It matches a Lancia. Think of the little things a forger wouldn't even know about. When you look at the cloth itself, the wound is on the left side of the man. But when you take the photograph and you look at the positive, one of the features of photography, when you go from negative to positive, you not only get light-dark reversal, you get left-right reversal. The forger would have had to have been smart enough to encode the features precisely correct on the left side that would actually line up, and it would know centuries later medically that only a wound on the right side could produce blood from the right auricle, which fills with blood at death. And so that's another indication this wound occurs after death. But the blood marks, if you took them, and I've been a volunteer in these subjects, if you take coagulated blood from a human body, you cannot transfer it to the cloth with the precision found in the shroud. You can't begin to. First of all, it's never happened on any other burial garments or cloths, blankets, sheets, or anything like that. But when people have been trying this intentionally for years, Vignon and Barbet, famous scientist and pathologist who studied the shroud, and recently a scientist in St. Louis, did an extensive study of trying to transfer blood onto cloth. And he couldn't get one blood mark to match, let alone 130, and have them perfectly aligned. The blood... Okay, one of the other characteristics of body image is very superficial and only goes a fiber or two deep. The blood marks seep into the cloth, and they're not superficial at all, but they're encoded after all the blood has coagulated on the body. But the blood marks have been embedded within the linen itself, and have almost the same appearance on the outer side of the shroud as they do on the frontal side. It's impossible to put coagulated blood into the middle of the cloth without breaking or smearing the blood marks at the edges, which is how the shroud's blood marks appear. So it's even harder to naturalistically or artistically encode the blood marks than it is the body image.
Unless, I suppose, you are using a really crucified person for your artwork, which is stretching things, it has to be said.
And no, you couldn't.
No?
You could not encode the blood marks if you, like I said, just cut yourself on a small area on your body and try to encode that with cloth. With the precision found on the shroud, it's never been seen before.
Okay. So we're actually then talking about an unknown process that puts the blood onto the cloth, are we?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to that later. That's actually something that I find less convincing about your suggestion. I mean, so far, a lot of these things, of course, are very convincing, and it's really very intriguing. Another thing I want to mention here, of course, is the missing thumbs, which you'd think, well, how would they know about that? I mean, that looks like an anomaly. As you look at the hands on the shroud, and there are only four fingers. What's happened to the thumbs? And it turns out that actually that's what you would have expected to see in the real situation. Can you explain that?
Yes. If you had real nails in the wrist, it would cause the nail to hit the median nerve, which would cause the thumb to contract into the palm. And since the man in the shroud's hands have been folded over his groin, it appears that his thumbs are missing, but they're just inside of the palm, and other scientists concur with this. This is just consistent. Many people have thought, well, the shroud cannot be authentic because the Old Testament prophesizes that the Messiah will not have a bone broken in him. And there's a whole appendix indicating that the Old Testament does prophesy the events of the Passion, Crucifixion, Death, Burial, and Resurrection of Jesus that are in my book. But some of them said, well, he couldn't have been nailed into the wrist because the wrist has a lot of small bones. And if you nailed in the wrist, it would break some bones. However, experiments with cadavers by Pierre Barbet showed that if you nail it right in the area located, indicated on the shroud, that you would separate four small bones and provide a basis for a man to hang suspended on the cloth, which the man in the shroud did. And it would cause the thumbs to contract. And
that's an incredible detail.
Yes. You can search thousands of surviving pictures of the crucifixion. It was literally the most important, most duplicated subject in all of art history. None of them have nails depicted in the wrist. Some of them are in the heel area or are heading toward the wrist, between the palm and the wrist. None of them have depictions in the wrist and the thumbs contracted into the thumbs. It's just another point of authenticity that a forger would not have done.
Okay, so we would have to hypothesize some forger who knew about Roman execution methods when they hadn't been carried out for the last 1,000 years. Yeah, that would, yes, indeed, that's an interesting one. What about the pollen? A lot of people say, well, the pollen is the right kind of pollen from the Palestine area and from the first century. But I understand, again, Walter McCrone said, no, that's an exaggeration. There were a few pollen grains discovered on a guy called Max Fry's sticky tape that he did experiments, you know, he tested. And McCrone even suggests perhaps that Max Fry was guilty of, exaggeration or even forgery himself.
I have no reason to think, and there's no evidence to indicate, that Max Fry was guilty of anything. Some pollen experts have not identified as many species or genuses from the shroud as Max Fry has, but they have not studied as many of the pollens as Max Fry has. Max Fry's collection needs to be more extensively studied by the experts. I'm all for that.
Okay.
But Fry, who got to study the entire collection, unlike Walter McCrone, finds more than a few pollens. Fry identifies 58 different species or genuses of pollens that indicate they were all grown. The presence of these are only found in one area, and that is Jerusalem and the surrounding area. While you find these same species in Genesis in other parts of the world, you don't find them collectively in any other one location. Now, a forger could have forged something like that. He would have had to have anticipated a technology probably 400 years later that could identify these things, but a forger could have done that, unlike the other things that people suggest. A forger could have taken a handful of pollens from different flowers and sprinkled them on the shroud.
Yeah, I see that. On the other hand, sometimes I wonder whether the accidental hypothesis sometimes can have explanatory power. I'm not saying it does in this case, but one could imagine that perhaps the forger thinks, I think I'll get a linen cloth from the right area of the world for all sorts of reasons. Maybe it's the right style, maybe it's the right weave, and because they do that, they end up with the right pollen on there.
Yes. If a forger did all those things, and even if he had a crucified volunteer,
yes, okay,
and wrapped him in the cloth, he could not begin to duplicate the precision of the full-length frontal and dorsal images and 130 blood marks. And he's not going to produce even a smaller thing like a facial image or a hand image or something like that. Not with all the features you have on the shroud. Mm. And he's not going to produce one blood mark with all the precision that's found on the shroud as well.
All right, so if I throw at you just the headlines of the theories that have been proposed, you can confidently say to me none of them work. So we have sun bleaching, we have scorching, we have brass rubbing, we have block printing, we have plaster mold and vapors. We even have a sort of early form of photography suggested, which I'll come back to that one in a moment, actually. So you're saying, of course, we've already had this Maillard reaction thing, which we talked about earlier. So you're saying that none of those things are up to the job?
Yes. And the proof is in the pudding. Proof is in the results. None of them have duplicated all the things I'm talking about. And we've only talked about a few image features. There's about, and we can do this later, there's well over 30 different identifiable features throughout the shroud's body images that somebody would have to duplicate, not just on a little part of the sample, the entire body images.
Well, absolutely. And this is why people need to read your book, which is an inch and a half thick. And I have it here. It's a real doorstopper. You know, it's obviously decades of work have gone into that. And it's a fascinating read. I do recommend people read it. So I'm going to bring back this, what I'm calling a proto-photography suggestion, just because it seemed rather extravagant, but interesting. So this was an arts professor who suggested this, a Dr. Nicholas Allen. And he claims to have reproduced something like the shroud image. And he used the suggestion, which was given by Leonardo da Vinci, who wrote about the camera obscura. So he thought, right, well, I'll do something like that. And he made a room into a kind of camera obscura and apparently hung this sculpture of a body in a room, somehow managed to get light to be projected off that sculpture onto a cloth that he soaked in silver sulfate. And so after that exposure, I don't know how long it took, but after that light exposure, he then used an ammonia solution to clean off that cloth. And hey presto, he has an image which was a bit like the Shroud of Turin. Did he solve it?
No, I devote a section to him in my 2000 book. Uh-huh. He probably comes the closest of any attempt to duplicate the images on the shroud. Now, there's some major problems.
Well, it sounds good. On the surface, that sounds good from my description.
Yeah. But go on. He does not produce any of the 130 blood marks or explain how their features get on the shroud. He describes a process where it would take 3 days exposure to his, I call it a medieval photography technique. The body would not stay, by his own descriptions, it would take 3 days for the frontal side to be encoded. It would take 3 more days for the dorsal side to be encoded. This man is in rigor mortis. It would not stay in rigor mortis for 6 days. You would literally have to take him to the top of the Alps or something like that. But then you'd get all the complicating problems of reflections from the snow and ice and things like that, you'd have to keep the body frozen for 6 days.
Did he reproduce the 3D effect as well with that?
He did not do bad on a frontal image with a photographic negative. He does not use a body. He has to use things like towels for the hair and other techniques like that. But if you look at his three-dimensional images, I have his, I think it's on page 86 of my 2000 book. His are on there as well as the ones from Picnet and Prince, who he got the idea from. And those two actually criticize each other's techniques very much as well, and explain the shortcomings in their techniques. But his 3D images do not look anything like the shrouds, in answer to your question. It is an innovative technique, but he does not use medieval products. He uses a 20th century lens for his medieval camera obscura technique. He does not use any types of lens that would have existed in medieval times. He uses 20th century products as well.
Yes, I did wonder about that with respect to the silver sulfate as well. I presume that's not something that would have been known about in Renaissance times, is it?
No, and silver nitrate would not have worked. I will give him this. His is one of the more innovative techniques, who has better results than some of the others we have been describing. But he can't use it with medieval products, and his results are inferior even when he adds in 20th century products.
Okay. Well, now, I'm going to be a bit facetious, so please do forgive me. We go now to 1988, and of course, all our conversation is a bit superfluous because it was proven once and for all that it was, in fact, a forgery, because in 1988, they carbon dated the shroud and it turned out to be from the medieval period. So all our conversation is a bit superfluous, isn't it?
Well, unfortunately, that's how most of the world who has even heard of the Shroud of Turin concludes. Whereas before it was known as a medieval painting, now it's considered a medieval forgery because literally one out of thousands of tests that have been conducted on the shroud and its samples, one result is inconsistent with the shroud being the burial garment of Jesus, and that is its radiocarbon dating. And my hypothesis addresses this directly.
It does indeed, but it's a bit convoluted here, isn't it? Because, I mean, the research, when you look at it on the surface, seems pretty convincing because we've got various institutes. We've got Oxford University, of all places. Oxford, they can't be wrong, can they? The Swiss Institute of Technology in Zurich, University of Arizona. So we have these independent tests going on, and they cut out this piece from the shroud, and amazingly, they've given permission to do that. And they come up with this time window between them of 1260 AD to 1390 AD, and so it looks there like, well, they found it nice, fairly squarely within the medieval period. However, it becomes convoluted, as you say, in a minute you'll talk about your thesis and how this addresses it, but the reason why it becomes convoluted is because that research was then brought into question by some researchers who, now you may correct me on their names, but I think Sue Burford and Joe Marino, some researchers who suggested that in fact the area that was tested was not a genuine part of the shroud at all, but it was a repair. But you don't agree with that, do you?
Well, these are two wonderful people who I knew for years. Unfortunately, Sue has passed away. I've known Joe Marino for as long as I've studied the shroud, almost as long. The only thing about their hypothesis is that there's really no evidence on the shroud or from its samples to support that. Certainly no elemental analysis of samples. It's very, very, very speculative.
So it was a repair to the cloth, isn't it? That's the idea. That it was repaired with cotton or something, and they claimed that you could see evidence of the cotton and the linen intertwined. And I believe that even Ray Rogers agreed with that eventually.
Yes, it's been known for years that some of the shroud samples contain small amounts of cotton. Now, the samples primarily consist of linen, but if it was the loom that wove the shroud, if it had also been woven at any other previous occasions with cotton, traces of cotton would be within any subsequent cloth that was woven, in this case, linen. There is a seam that's a couple of inches from one of the long edges running all the way the length of the cloth. And near the seam is where the first indications of traces of cotton were found. Right above this area is where the shroud radiocarbon dating sample was taken from. And there could be other traces of cotton in those samples. But it doesn't mean that it was a repair, because the traces of cotton are found, well, it's probably found in other locations. It doesn't just, you know, it's like saying if you find a trace of vermilion that the images were painted, it just means that there's some cotton on the shroud. Somebody would have had to have matched the repair piece with the whole cloth in a way that it confounds scores of scientists who have examined the shroud and scores of instruments that have examined it under X-radiography and fluorescence analysis, and there's just no evidence for it. It's an interesting hypothesis, and I certainly have nothing against it, but you can claim anything in a hypothesis, but you have to have some evidence to support it.
Yes, indeed. I just thought that it was necessary to bring that up because it did get a lot of press. And of course, those people who wish to believe that the carbon dating is wrong jumped upon it. Of course, it's a valid argument. Okay, so we're left then at the moment in our conversation with the carbon dating intact. However, your thesis directly addresses that. So now really this is the opportunity for you to flesh out your thesis and how it addresses that and other items in the argument as well.
Okay. And by the way, my hypothesis to test, or my proposal to test the shroud at the atomic and molecular level, could prove or disprove not only the repair hypothesis, but all the image forming hypotheses that we've discussed so far, and many that we haven't. But my hypothesis is that an extensive amount of evidence indicates that radiation was the encoding agent for the full-length body images that are found on the shroud. It can account for all these features, the vast majority of which we haven't even had an opportunity to discuss because the evidence is so extensive. There just isn't time to do everything. And the evidence indicates that the source of the radiation not only is the body itself, but it can only be the body. You cannot have all these features duplicated on the shroud unless the radiation came from the body, which is also clearly indicated that it has been tortured and crucified and died in the vertical position. The evidence also indicates that it's particle radiation. Think of particle radiation as primarily consisting of protons and neutrons, which comprise 99.9% of the mass or the weight of all atoms. And the evidence indicates that the body appears to have disappeared. If the body did disappear and gave off some of the basic elements of atoms or matter, it's feasible that it could have been protons and neutrons. Well, it's one thing to say that and propose it. We propose a series of tests that could be conducted on the Shroud of Turin that could find three radioactive atoms that are all over the cloth. Many, many more of these atoms would be on the body image itself and on the actual blood marks. But these radioactive atoms were not even known to exist until after 1932, when scientists throughout the world were conducting all of these tests. A good part of these tests are seeing what happens when you irradiate neutrons onto various material containing your common variety of atoms.
Okay, so you're talking about neutron radiation specifically, is that correct?
Yes.
And the atoms that you evidence in the text, chlorine and calcium, are those the two that you particularly concentrate on here?
Two of the three, yes.
Right, okay. So if neutron radiation did in fact, well, I would just say it emanates from the body. You're suggesting that the body somehow is going through a process where it is partly converted into this radiation. So neutron radiation is coming from the body in that sense. And so it's changing the chlorine atoms and the calcium atoms into a slightly different form of that element. And that state would have a very long half-life, is that correct? So that you'd still be able to detect the effect even after all these years?
The radioactive atoms have half-lives of hundreds of thousands of years. Yes, you could detect them. A very, very, very tiny fraction of neutrons from the body, like 1/1,000,000%, are given off as this body, a lay description is disappears, but it's probably, again, this is just speculative, but it probably does something like goes to a different dimension or something like that where you cannot, you cannot observe it or something like that. But the body doesn't reform. It just, as it goes to another dimension, a tiny, tiny fraction, about 1/1,000,000% of its neutrons are given off uniformly. But that would create billions and billions and billions of radioactive atoms throughout the shroud. And two of these radioactive atoms, since they have long lives, 99% of these atoms would still be present on the shroud today if it was irradiated 2,000 years ago. And that's interesting.
So that would be detectable. And this wouldn't cause any damage to the shroud to do a test like that?
Yes, it would. Ah. To measure them, you would have to take tiny samples from strategic locations and take them to an accelerator mass spectrometer. It's the same technology that measures another radioactive atom, and that is carbon-14. But let's stick with these two for now. These radioactive chlorine and calcium atoms can only be created by neutrons. However brilliant a medieval or forger from any era could have been, he could not have even had access to neutron radiation until the 20th century.
Okay, so why should we not think, this is assuming they are in fact discovered, that some natural process could have given rise to these neutrons?
Neutrons are not given off in that way. Neutron bodies, alive bodies or dead bodies or any objects, my telephone or my water bottle, whatever, bodies do not give off neutrons. Neutrons exist, are found within the nucleus of an atom. And of course, atoms reside at the molecular level of the material that they're found in, whether it's a desk or a cloth or blood or limestone or things like that. They're not given off. Like I said, they weren't discovered until the 20th century. And to give them off, it takes a nuclear generator to release them.
Okay. Right. And so a very interesting aspect of this hypothesis is that it fits neatly with a critique of the carbon dating, because you say that it would invalidate those 1988 findings if, in fact, the neutron radiation was given off by the body.
All scientists, including the laboratory scientist who dated the shroud in 1988, would agree. It's been known now for decades, that if neutrons irradiate an object such as a linen cloth or blood marks, it will create three radioactive atoms in the material within the cloth or with the blood or any material that received the neutrons. These new radioactive atoms would be found in this material, and these radioactive atoms can only be created by neutrons. That's probably step one. The other intriguing aspect is they've done so much research over the decades, they realize that these radioactive atoms are created at known rates. In other words, they know how many neutrons a piece of material would had to have received before a certain number of these radioactive atoms would appear. And they can calculate that because these radioactive atoms appear at known rates, and they also disappear at known rates. It's getting a little complicated, but these things allow scientists to not only determine whether a piece of material such as a shroud of Turin was irradiated with neutrons, but they could tell how many neutrons each particular location received. And they could tell you when the radiating event occurred as well. And if they took samples from the off-image areas and on-image areas, they could even confirm that the source of the neutron radiation was not only the body that was wrapped in that shroud, but the length, width, and depth of the body was the source. And so it's quite intriguing at that point, but what we predict you would find is you would find the radioactive atoms, the three of them, would be distributed according to their closeness to the body and their position upon the body or underneath the body for the dorsal side. And that since blood has a lot more chlorine and calcium and nitrogen within it, it would have many more of these radioactive atoms in there. But now you're talking about an event that could never have been duplicated at any age. While scientists in the 20th century could produce neutron radiation, they certainly can't make it in the 21st century or under any technique. They can't make it come from a body, let alone the length or width or depth of a dead body.
So just to kind of summarize then here, I'm getting the impression that the carbon-14 dating, well, in your theory here, is wrong, because according to your theory, there would be a lot more carbon-14 in the cloth due to the radiation. And so when it's tested later on, they're expecting it to have decayed at a certain rate and thinking, oh, yeah, well, this dates it back to the medieval period. But actually, it's a lot more there than expected. And so, in fact, it may go back to the first century and they don't realize why. That's basically it, is it?
Yes, the lower left-hand corner that we were talking about, that's near the edge of a seam, which would have been a good distance from the bulk of the body, would have received radiation, neutrons, and would have created carbon-14. And the additional radioactive atoms within the cloth would make the cloth appear younger, as you say. However, if you take another location of just a little bit higher than this location, it would appear even younger yet. As you went up the side of the cloth, the body would start getting a little bit closer to the bulkier parts of the man. Instead of being right across from his ankles, which is where the 1988 sample was taken from, as you get higher, his calves are bigger, his thighs are bigger, his buttocks, his back, his chest, all those things are thicker. And as you even went up the side, you would have gotten more indirect neutrons that are ricocheting around. And in fact, the small sample that the labs saw, they show a pattern of it getting younger in just the small direction that they're going. And in fact, they see such a range of dates within the three little samples that are side by side that the range of error is outside the accepted means, and it indicates something systematic is wrong. The data is not wrong. The number of carbon-14 atoms that they're counting is in the ballpark. But to get this much of a range in such a small area, it looks like you have something systematically wrong with these results. We don't know what the answer is. Instead of saying we would like another sample somewhere else, and originally they were supposed to take samples from different locations, the labs instead, and this is detailed in the book, they start averaging some dates to minimize the plus or minus range of dates. It minimizes the range of dates. And they average, instead of 8 dates from Arizona, they combine those 8 dates into 4 dates. And it barely gets them their dates within an acceptable range. Well, what they should have done and were supposed to do is to consult with other scientific institutions. And they did not. They did not. And you could easily take samples from 2 or 3 locations on the shroud, find all 3 of these radioactive atoms in there, and get 3 drastically different carbon dates from them as well. The carbon date is simply measuring the additional carbon-14 atoms as well as any existing atoms. Well, the labs think all the carbon-14 atoms they're counting is left over from when the cloth was manufactured. It's decayed at a certain rate. Well, that's an assumption that is not warranted and could be completely disproven. If you took a sample from the body image, it would date to an impossible date. It would date to the future. And some of them would be like thousands of years into the future. Only neutrons can cause you to date so far into the future.
Okay, yes, you're saying if that was the carbon dating result, then that would indicate radiation. That's what you're saying.
Yes.
Right. And so you're also saying in a way that the carbon-14 dating wouldn't really be saying much about the dating of the cloth. It would rather be saying, if you could take enough little samples that corresponded to the image, it would be more saying something about how the image itself was formed. It would corroborate your thesis to do with radiation.
Yes. And it would completely refute the accuracy of the 1988 radiocarbon dating of the shroud. And would indicate that whatever word you wanted to use, I'll use a unique radiating event that occurred to the crucified corpse wrapped within the Shroud of Turin.
It's a fascinating hypothesis. It really is. And I do think it needs to be done. As I say, just in a second, I'm going to say I don't think it's without its difficulties, but then what hypothesis is?
Yes.
You also say that you could extend this to the tomb itself. I mean, you have a couple of contenders here. You have the garden tomb, which is the nice one to look at. And you have the one that's buried under the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which I understand many scholars believe is very probably the real site. Hence, there's a church built on top. But you say that maybe you could actually test the limestone in the tomb, but is there sufficient limestone left to do any tests on?
There may be some limestone from the walls of the tomb itself. Most new Second Temple tombs, which is the kind that Jesus was buried in, had like a U-shaped bench in the middle of a small tomb. The bench was probably destroyed around the 11th century. And perhaps the entire tomb, we don't know. There may be some walls surviving from that. If this was Jesus' actual burial tomb, and if there are any surviving remnants of it, even though the remnants may not have been right near the body, there is still a decent chance that some of these radioactive atoms would be within the encircling walls, if they were not destroyed and you have the right location.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, so let me lastly then put a few questions to you, stroke objections, see how you respond to this. So, one thing that did occur to me would be to say, well, wouldn't you expect, you know, if the radiation was coming from the body was going through a process where it was being converted into a glorified, resurrected body, you'd expect the radiation to be massive and destroy the shroud. But you've already answered that, I think, because you say that it would be a disappearing body and there would only be this very small amount of radiation. Okay. However, why would we expect the body to disappear? I mean, you know, when I think of resurrection, I don't normally think of a disappearing body. I think of Jesus's body being transformed inside the grave clothes and thus, you know, entering this new state of resurrected life. And then he'd cast off the grave clothes and exit the tomb. And hence, of course, we have the stone rolled away, which suggests this new body that's there. So why would we think of a body disappearing?
Well, disappearing is, it's about the best word that a lay person can come up with. If this happened to the dead body of the man in the shroud, he would not have removed the covers and walked away. I don't think that's what happened to Jesus either. And while it doesn't specify exactly in the Gospels, it gives the appearance that when Peter and John come in and they look at the burial cloths, they immediately knew that the body wasn't taken. It probably had a collapsed look to it, not the kind of look that somebody just took the shroud and flipped it off away from them. If it gives off radiation, if a dead body gives off a neutron radiation and goes off to a different dimension, it's no longer physically where it was. I can't explain where it went. It could have simply went on the other side of the tomb a few feet away.
Sure. No, but my question is, why should we think that resurrection involves going into a different dimension that we would describe as disappearance? Because it seems to me that resurrection seems to be a transformation of the body into a new state so that it's still a body.
Yes, it just disappeared from the tomb or disappeared from your physical view. It could have theoretically been just a few feet away inside the tomb, but it no longer is within the cloth itself.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm not saying that couldn't have happened, but what I'm wondering is whether the idea is generated in order to fit the theory. Is it a bit ad hoc?
The body image part of the hypothesis, I'm trying to keep it understandable. All the features that you find on the shroud cannot be accounted for by a radiating body unless the body disappears and the top part of the cloth collapses momentarily into this small, low-energy field of radiation, and it just happens within a very, very, very short period of time, probably less than a second or so.
Yeah, so it's a requirement of the theory that this happened.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's wrong, but it is a requirement of the theory that the body disappears so that there isn't so much energy that it destroys the cloth. Instead, it creates this image. It's a requirement.
Yeah. We are working ourselves backwards from the features found on the shroud. We're not working from the Gospels. But when you get done, you do see a convergence.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. But the problem is that as hypotheses become more detailed like this, and there are sub-clauses, they become less elegant. And so in my view, they become slightly less convincing. I'm not saying, you know, it's wrong, but slightly less convincing. The other thing is that you say that the cloth sort of fell down through the radiation. Is that right? In order to create the image, because the body disappeared.
Yeah.
Whatever we want to describe it, gone into a different dimension. Now, some people say that would we not expect the cloth to have not just dropped, but because of the vacuum that's created, to have been pulled in at all sides? And therefore, would you really get this nice straight up and down image? Wouldn't it be rather distorted?
Well, you can only go so far in what you say. There is a possibility, and I try to keep it as basic as I can. There's a possibility that the radiation given off, I've heard other scientists say this. I don't quite agree with this, but certainly I agree that there's a possibility that the radiation was given off in a collimated vertical direction. But I think, and I'm just taking the sides of another scientist, but I think that the radiation was given off as it normally would, and that's uniformly, and that the cloth provides the directionality to it. If it just disappeared or went to a different dimension, you have to understand that the sides of the cloth would not be right on top of the body. And by time they were pulled in toward the body region, the body long ago disappeared. This takes a fraction of a second, and it's only going to affect the frontal and dorsal parts of the shroud that are right near the body. Parts of it is touching the body, and parts very close to it are very, very close to it. And so in that tiny fraction of a second that any radiation is given off, only the parts above the cloth and below the cloth would have received any of that radiation. The parts to the side, you know, that they would have received it in 5 seconds or something like that, but it would not have received it in a fraction of a second.
Yeah, that seems to make sense to me. Okay, thank you for that. I think the other one which concerns me more is why we should think that radiation has any part in resurrection at all. I do have difficulty with that. Why do you think that?
I don't think radiation is inconsistent with the resurrection. And we're probably aware of things like the transformation of Jesus involved a glow from his body. I think when Paul is on the road to Esopus, Damascus. Sure. When he hears a voice and there's a light on him, there's a number of other incidences. I think the twinkling of an eye is described in, this is Paul again in Corinthians, when he describes the resurrection process that we will go through like Jesus. The details of the resurrection are not described. All that the apostles know is that when Peter and John, who are the first ones to get there, when they arrive, Jesus' body is gone and they can't explain it. And the tomb has been opened. By the way, you could only open the tomb if a person did it from the outside. You could not open it from the inside. You'd have to roll it from the outside. The radiation from the body is based upon the evidence on the shroud. The details of the resurrection are not described in the Gospels.
Oh, okay. So the highly suggestive things, the sort of symbolic things to do with light and white and brightness and bright linen and all these sorts of things that are there in the Bible, suggestive of holiness, of otherness, and I can see those are there. But they do strike me as symbolic, very powerful symbols. And here we're moving into the territory, are we not, of scientific statements. And it doesn't seem to me that there's a parallel in any tangible scientific sense between radiation, understood scientifically, and symbolism to do with white and light and bright. You know, it's a kind of poetic connection, but I think that's all it is.
Yes, and I agree with you. And in fact, the particle radiation would not have been in the visible spectrum.
Right.
If you were standing inside the tomb, you would not have seen with the narrow range of visibility that a human has as far as radiation. They would not have been able to see it in what's called the visible spectrum. A god or something could certainly see it in all the spectrums, but it wouldn't have been that kind of so-called UV or electromagnetic radiation that is within our visible spectrum. So it's just a general indirect consistency with some of the miracles involving Christ in the New Testament. It's not a detailed, you're right, it's a general or poetic, if you want to use that term, but not a item by item similarity.
Well, this brings me then to my last thought, really, and that is, I mean, I obviously from the discussion you can pick up that I am both intrigued by your suggestion and also have some reservations about it, which I'm enjoying. it's nice to explore an idea that you're attracted to and also have questions about. But I just want you to comment upon my thought about this. It's not easy to explain, but let me put it this way. I am attracted to your idea. I do think it has a lot going for it. I have trouble with the fact that it requires this sub-hypothesis involving a disappearing body, from, you know, obviously from what we've just been talking about. You know, I'm not saying that body couldn't disappear. I'm not saying that Jesus, you know, was unable to move miraculously from one place to another. I believe that he was. I just have trouble with the theory requiring that when it's not clear to me from the biblical narrative that that's the case. Now, however, I do think your suggestion has force, and I think you make a very good case for this to be taken seriously by the scientific community. And I say that on this basis. If the specific type of radiation that you describe is discovered, as you hypothesize, then this might point to resurrection as the only feasible explanation that we have to date for what we actually see on the shroud. Now, I'm not saying that I think there is a link between radiation and resurrection. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that resurrection would seem to be the only feasible explanation for that radiation. So what I'm saying is, up to this point in time, no competing suggestion seems to have a hope of accounting for that specific form of radiation, so far as I know. Whereas the resurrection might do. So should that be discovered, the resurrection would seem to be the only game in town. Now that seems quite a modest position that I've sketched out there. But, you know, it's one that I can live with, having talked to you and read your book. So I don't come at this thinking this is a kind of knockdown argument, but one which is modestly suggesting if you find this radiation, then resurrection looks like the only thing that we have to go on. Now, what I find about this particular way of approaching it is that that kind of argument would be perhaps attractive to believers, but perhaps not so attractive to unbelievers. And yet in your book, you say this would be very persuasive to unbelievers as well. I'm not quite so sure about that. I wonder whether you already need to believe in the notion of resurrection to be able to say to yourself, if that radiation is found, then resurrection would be the best explanation we have. Don't you already need to believe in the resurrection to conclude that?
Well, I'll try to address your two main points. There is a consistency between the disappearance of Jesus and the hypothesis. We go on into chapter 12, and we argue that it appears that the blood reappeared and that the body reappeared just in two different locations, but that's too much detail here. But our hypothesis is consistent with the fact the body not only disappeared, but it reappeared. And we have more evidence for this with the blood, but we still take that position with the body. And if you think about it, in the Gospels, after the resurrection, there, I believe, are three instances. One of them is on the road to Emmaus, where Jesus, this is after the resurrection, he sees the two downcast apostles who have not heard of Jesus' resurrection, and he starts talking to them, and they're amazed by him. And then when they break bread, remember, Jesus' body disappears, and he's seen soon thereafter by some other apostles, and everyone is amazed. We're not claiming that the body disintegrated and then reintegrated itself. We're just saying, like the Gospels describe, it disappeared and then is visible again somewhere else. We obviously couldn't begin to explain what's going on, except in very general terms, like we think is going to another alternate dimensionality and then simply returning to it. But this occurs in three instances. Two others is the apostles are inside of a locked room, and Jesus is not with them when they go in the room. When they lock the room, suddenly he appears within the room. And that's mentioned in John. The first one, the road to Emmaus, is mentioned in Luke. To get to your other larger point, who knows? But I think this subject is more important in a very critical way to non-Christians than Christians. For Christians, it can bolster their faith. But for someone like me who is an agnostic, or someone who's an atheist, or someone who belongs to another religion, they could all of a sudden find an evidentiary path to eternal life after death that they may not have been getting otherwise. The explanation in Christianity would all of a sudden have a lot of evidence that the key part of it that Jesus resurrected, and that if you believe in his resurrection, you too can have life after death. All of a sudden, you start to think, gee, these were real events.
Right. So what you seem to be saying to me then is that this notion of the resurrection might be the only game in town.
Yeah.
If the radiation is discovered, as you suggest, and it's highly impressive, this idea that the resurrection is the only game in town, although it would be immediately attractive to Christians, of course, nevertheless would be highly suggestive to anybody else that they might actually think, oh, well, just a minute, I really do need to look into this, and then actually go to the New Testament, actually perhaps even look at biblical studies, evidence that will be associated with it, etc., 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 if they're looking at it in an evidential way. And so this would be part of a cumulative case for the resurrection, and that's how it would be powerful. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. What if you were an agnostic or a member of another religion or a belief in a different philosophy, and all of a sudden you realize, now this is assuming the tests and experiments are conducted in a few years and they get the results we're saying.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And if you saw thousands of items and then millions of items you'd get from the molecular level and billions of items you'd get from the radioactive level, this adds up to a number that only the guy in charge of the federal deficit in the United States knows how big it is. But you know, all of a sudden you saw all of this objective and independent evidence that really can't be forged or occur naturally. And then you look at your own particular philosophy or religion and you see no evidence, you say, hey, wait a minute. I may not have any control over what happens to me when I die, but I can at least make the most intelligent decision and stop and think, what's at stake? My life after death. I'm risking my entire life and my afterlife on something that has no evidence when I just came across billions of items of evidence indicating that the central premises of Christianity are true. You're risking a lot on your beliefs. Why not base it on evidence like you do every when I cross the street and you do too? You look both ways. You look logic. You assess the facts. You go across the street. You make hundreds of logical decisions every day. Why not use that same thing? You would also be understanding from this evidence, you would be able to answer to some extent, anyway, questions about the existence and nature of God. It could make exploring outer space look like a dull, boring job. People could explore the question of eternity based on evidence for the first time ever.
I think this is one of the reasons why I find your book so attractive, actually, is because precisely what you said just a few minutes ago is, if this turns out to be the case, if these tests are carried out and it's shown to be that this radiation is there, as you describe, then these things follow as we've said before, as the only game in town. All right, that's fascinating, but it's all premised upon if this turns out to be the case, which is what your book essentially is calling for the scientific community to take this seriously and say, look, this is of such existential importance here. We really do need to test this shroud, hence the title of your book, Test the Shroud. You are making this big call out there to everybody to do this. So you're not actually saying, look, this is the proof, it's all signed and sealed and that's the end of it. This is just an invitation. And I think you do that extremely well based upon all the research that you've done over the years. And I encourage people to read this book. And I really do thank you for coming on the show to talk about it. Fascinating conversation, fascinating book. And the last thing really, I suppose, to ask is, you know, people will want to know where to go to. And of course, your Test the Shroud Foundation has a website, doesn't it? Can you lead people to that?
Yes, it's testtheshroud.com. You can also go to it on testtheshroud.org. You can receive books now from that website. Started on January 1st, the books are going to be distributed into bookstores around the United States. We hope it's soon in bookstores in the UK and Europe and other places in the world. But it will be available on Amazon.com beginning January of 2017. And yes, you can get it right now on testtheshroud.com and testtheshroud.org.
Great. And just before I sign off here, I have to ask you what kind of reaction you have had from the public in general and perhaps even from people who are part of, as we call them, the scientific community.
I have been getting, it's early to tell here, but the initial results, I've been pleasantly surprised, is I've been getting very good reaction from the scientific community who has read it. I've had a number of very top-notch scientists contact me, and we're hoping to expand the scientific influence of this. There's going to be a conference held in Washington in 2017. Many scientists are responding to that now. I can also tell the listeners that Shroud 2017 conference website. Now this is not going to occur till July, so there's plenty of time to plan for it, but we're hoping to expand this information that we've discussed today and to undertake new tests in a wide variety of areas discussed in the book and in other locations, and to refine, is it radiation? Was it collimated radiation or given off uniformly? What type of radiation and all that kind of stuff? And with the science of today, you can answer questions that, of course, people only dreamed about not that long ago. Mm. It's really incredulous how things start overlapping after a while. You would think that science and religion did not have anything in common, but yet they may be able to ascertain the most unique events that ever occurred in human history.
Well, this is one of the bees in my bonnet, actually. I believe that a lot of academic disciplines interpenetrate each other much more than people often realize. I keep saying I'm going to ask you a last question, so this is my last question. And that is, the Vatican has been pretty good so far. Okay, they've had concerns in the past, but they've said, yes, all right, go ahead. But, I mean, this time you're asking for more damage to be done to the Shroud. I mean, have you got any indication of whether they're likely to say yes to this?
Well, please read very, very carefully. First of all, the testing that we want to do at the molecular level, which would give them so much more information, it would take years to analyze and categorize because it would be at the molecular level. That's all non-destructive. Some of the testing at the atomic level, for example, we talked about testing. It appears that there could be some limestone walls still available. If there's limestone walls, we would only need a tiny amount. I'm talking about something about the size of a thimble or something like that. That wouldn't be harmful at all. And you could test for two of the three radioactive atoms there.
But I can imagine them being rather more touchy about the Shroud itself, though, understandably.
Hey, I'm going there. Oh. The charred material is basically burnt linen, and there may be some burnt blood. There used to be charred material on the Shroud that was there for 500 years. It was only removed in 2002, and it's been there since 1532. But two of the three radioactive atoms would be in that charred material. There are 42 vials of charred material that has various amounts of charred material from different locations on the Shroud from behind its patches. You would only need a small amount of those, so you could test those as well. Now, testing samples from the Shroud, even there, they can be very, very minimally invasive. Far larger number of these radioactive atoms would be on the blood marks than on the linen, because there's so much more of these atoms. Blood is far more dense than linen. You could take just a dot of the blood, and there's 130 blood marks. If you took a couple of dots from two of the 130 locations, for example, the side wound is a massive amount of blood. If you took a dot from that, you're not disfiguring the Shroud. Maybe, 0.1% or something, but you could find out some really incredible information from it. And if you took the same right below the blood mark, you could take some of the linen, because you would still find these radioactive atoms in there. So you could do minimally invasive testing even on the cloth and the blood, and wouldn't harm a thing by testing the charred material and the limestone, and wouldn't harm it at all by doing the molecular testing. But we don't propose any radioactive testing of the Shroud itself or its blood until the technique is absolutely perfected and on control linen, you can nail it and get the results every single time. Until it's perfected, we don't even advocate that it be considered seriously.
Yeah, yeah, you've made an extremely good case. Yes, absolutely. They should relax. The Vatican should relax. In fact, I'll say now, if I was a member of the Vatican, I would say, yes, come on, let's go ahead with this because it's going to be okay. Yeah, you make a very persuasive case. And it has been a delight speaking to you. I know it's been such a long time in the coming, but it's been absolutely worth it. And a great and indeed challenging conversation, I'm sure, to listeners, but especially to me. And it has been a wonderful experience speaking with you, Mark Antonacci. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me and all the work that I can tell you put into this subject in preparing the questions.
Okay, well, that's it for this edition of TMR. Another long interview, I confess. This time not split into two parts because I've actually had time to deal with it this week, but nevertheless, a long interview, but I think a very interesting one nevertheless. And as I said in the interview, I do recommend anyone interested in this subject to get hold of a copy of Mark Antonacci's book, because it really is packed with information, and so far as I can see, makes every effort to leave no stone unturned. And as you heard in the interview, I'm saying this as someone who remains sceptical about the Shroud. I'm not pushing it as a dyed-in-the-wool Shroud believer, but just because I think it is well-researched and challenging, and as I often say, it's good for us, is it not, to be challenged in our thinking from time to time. So please do scoot over to testtheshroud.com. or testtheshroud.org, and get a copy. Next week, TMR will be breaking for the Christmas weekend. Then, all being well, we shall be joined once again by the Nephilim Boys of Like Flint Radio for another fireside session on New Year's Eve as the clock strikes 12. Or is that New Year's Day as the clock strikes zero? I'm never quite sure, anyway. So, another international chat with Garth Kennedy from Down Under, and Cruzy, I hope, will be joining us from South Africa, which I guess is still, as far as I'm concerned, Down Under, though not in the official sense. And Frank Johnson and Cliff Garner from the USA, and we'll be chatting, not too seriously, I hope, about pretty much everything under the sun again, from sea monsters, whether weaponized by the Russians or not, through moon holography to Nephilim fairies, whether weaponized by the Russians or not, and no doubt much more. So, fake news, I guess. Anyway, you decide on that. So that's it for now. In the meantime, I wish you all a very happy Christmas, wherever you are in the world, and I hope that you have been good enough this year to be visited by Father Christmas and all that jazz. So that's it for the moment. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, of themindrenewed.com, and I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.